come in.
Very nice. Let me start this off. Okay. So my talk, Classical and Quantum Indistinguishability. I think there's a bit of a difference in cultures going among physicists and philosophers. And being a philosopher of physics, I'm somewhat in between. I think the physicist's idea of a talk is essentially a chess problem. You set a problem, you find a solution, that's it. And then the finale is very simple. It's the knight, king, four, or something, checkmate, you know, that's the physicist's idea of a good talk and a clear talk and so forth. Now, a philosopher's idea of a talk is more of a crossword puzzle. You see, and the finesse and the artistry lies in the subtlety of the clues and using the enjoyment of seeing the pieces and so forth. And then you're asked to summarize a crossword puzzle. Well, what can we do? Now, the philosopher of physics, I think, is a slightly different game. The philosopher of physics idea of a talk is a jigsaw. This is what we see. This is therefore my answer. This is my idea of the talk. The indistinguishability of the jigsaw. It doesn't make it any easier to summarize. How do you summarize a jigsaw? I mean, you have to sort of present the finished picture. That's what I'll have to do at the end. Okay. So most of this puzzle, this jigsaw, is about classical indistinguishability rather than quantum. But the quantum issue arises and it becomes important as soon as the classical part of the jigsaw falls into place. If you think that classical indistinguishability is nonsense, as most physicists seem to think or have thought, then the puzzle doesn't present itself. Once you think, oh no, classical indistinguishability makes perfect sense, then you have a puzzle, which is what explains quantum statistics? So that'll be the latter part of my talk. The first part of my talk is really to convince you that classical indistinguishability is perfectly meaningful, perfectly intelligible, and so forth. And in a certain sense, universal, a priori. You know, that was my last talk. I was saying mirroring is, in a certain sense, a priori. And here I'm saying something similar. Permutation symmetry is, in a certain sense, a priori. But there's some evidence that physicists think it's all nonsense. And so this is from Stern. On a paper called On the Term in Factorial in the Entropy, he says, in conclusion, it should be emphasized in the foregoing remarks, classical statistics is considered in principle as a part of classical mechanics which deals with individuals, false. The conception of atoms as particles losing their identity cannot be introduced into the classical theory without contradiction. Thank you. And again, this is from Huang, a textbook still widely used. It is not possible to understand classically why we must divide by n factorial to obtain the correct counting of states. And yet a third, this is Bach, Alexander Bach, in an otherwise very good book, I have it here, in the Spring of Our Lives, 1997. Prior to the description of a state by means of probability measures, states were identified with point measures. In this deterministic setting, indistinguishable objects are not conceivable. So, it's good for red flag to fall, really. You know, all of this talk about it being unintelligible and inconceivable makes me determined to show otherwise. We must go by the authority of Schrödinger. It was a famous paradox pointed out for the first time by Gibbs that the same increase of entropy must not be taken into account when the two molecules are of the same gas, although, according to naive gas theoretical views, diffusion takes place then too, but unnoticeably to us, because all the particles are alike. The modern view of quantum mechanics solves this paradox by declaring that in the second case there is no real diffusion because exchange between like particles is not a real event. If it were, we should have to take account of it statistically. It has always been believed that Gibbs' paradox embodied profound thought, that it was intimately linked up with something so important and entirely new as quantum mechanics could hardly be foreseen. I think it's clear from that Schrödinger is saying only quantum mechanics solves this problem that otherwise is not understood classically. And actually in this book he goes on to say, well, really to second this account from Münster, classical statistics thus leads to a contradiction with experience, even in the range in which quantum effects in the proper sense can be completely neglected. And that perhaps feeds into perhaps a worldview. It's always difficult to ascertain just how widespread these beliefs are. then it fits in with the view that to get out to the n factorial term, really we need quantum mechanics. This is the signal, or some sort of signature of quantum mechanics. It shows us something wrong with the classical theory. And we correct it by quantum theory. And then, of course, in the dilute limit of the quantum system, you have classical statistics. So, as well. That's probably, I believe that to be the dominant view anyway. I'm welcome to be correct on this. Okay. Now, let me see. Yeah, I'll come back to that in a moment. Let me first just remind you of what Gibbs paradox is and what the n factorial business is about and so forth. So if I take the volume initially of two gases, and let's make them distinguishable gases, you know, one is neon and the other is hydrogen. and we have a barrier between the two halves of this volume and total volume 2V. And in fact, I can mix these two gases reversibly if only I have two membranes. This is gas A, this is gas B. So if this is permeable only to A, and this one permeable only to B. Okay, so I separate, I pull out these two membranes, and we'll agree I can do this as quasi-statically and so forth. And equally, when I compress them again, slowly, isothermally, and so forth, I again bring about the separation of the two gases. So this, in other words, is a reversible process. We can look at the entropy change. Look at the entropy change for gas A, dQ over T for some reversible process. And this is isothermal, so it's just the work that's being done. So PdV. And let's assume these gases are ideal. So we'll have NK, use the equation of state to express P in terms of the volume, over V, T, dV integral. So I'm going to get nk, and I'm dividing by t here. I'm going to get nk dV over V from a volume, initial volume V to 2V. So this will just be nk log 2V minus V, so log 2. I should have a subscript A for the n. This is I'm looking at the entropy change for gas of type A. Likewise, the gas of type B, so the total entropy change just NA plus NB K log 2, which is exactly what we'd expect just on general grounds. After mixing, you need information log 2 for each of the atoms has been lost. So we'd expect the entropy change accordingly. Now, what happens, and this is the Gibbs paradox, what happens as B and A become so alike that they are effectively indistinguishable, and then further, what if they're completely indistinguishable in some sort of limit? Well, I think the right thing to say about the business of how close together do they have to be before you see this entropy change is as close as you can distinguish through some device, something like the semi-permeable Brooklyn membrane, such that you can reversibly mix the gases and then separate them again. So when the gases are exactly alike, that is impossible, but you could imagine a Maxwell's beam capable of following trajectories of mixed particles and so forth. And if you had that, and Maxwell beam and present, mixing and then unmixing these two gases, you would still see the entropy change, even if the gas was exactly the same. I've not seen any discussions on this on the literature of Maxwell's beam, and perhaps on the but that seems to me to be right. So it's not so much that there's a puzzle from the traditional point of view. The problem is more, so suppose identical, forget about Maxwell's beam, what would we then say? Then we say no entropy change on mixing. And that follows not through, there's no reversible process available. At least we don't have the Maxwell's beam available, so we can't experimentally determine this. But still, entropy is normally taken to be an extensive function of state. So the problem becomes, how do we get an extensive entropy? And do distinguish additivity of the entropy from extensivity. Additivity is for two separate systems, you sum them to entropy. You always do that, but it's, if you like, a convention. Extensivity is really about mixing two systems. A system that's allowed to be in equilibrium, we imagine each part of it as being in equilibrium. Each part is in equilibrium. One removes a barrier, it's identical substances, what is the entropy change? Extensivity is the claim that the total entropy is just the sum of the two. And what happens when you try to compute the entropy in Boltzmann statistics? The answer is you get, I don't know if we should go through this, but let's do something very simple-minded. So look at a collection of N molecules, and they're confined to C, break up phase space into C cells, and make all of these of the same energy, so it's degenerate. And now one can compute the thermodynamic probability, W equal to n factorial, and you have n1 factorial in one of the cell, n2, n1 particles in one of the cell, n2 in the next, n3 in the next, and so forth. So how many ways of doing this? This many ways for a given set of these occupation numbers. So one then takes the maximum value of this. So one considers variation of W under variation of the choices of the occupation numbers. This is all very familiar, yes. Do I need to go through it at all? Can I go through it? I mean, the point being, if you look at delta W, actually, I need to look at delta logarithm of W. In the Stirling approximation, you're going to get n log n for the factorial minus n, and then you're subtracting off all of these, so that's the sum from k equals 1 to c, nk log nk minus nk. So this summing of these is just going to give you n, which will cancel this one, we'll be left with n log n minus sum nk log nk. Now consider variation of this quantity on the variations of the n, independent variations of the nks. This term, of course, doesn't change. What you're going to get is the variation in this thing will be sum of two terms, log ni, and the other one, this will, times delta ni, the one being k, not I, sorry, k is variation of this thing will give you 1 over nk, then times nk, so that's just a constant. The point is, it could be any constant, we can put a lambda here, because, let's see, when I multiply this thing, standard-determined multipliers. anyway, so this is right. I introduce a constant here, because this term here, variation under this term, has to vanish independently of this one. And what that tells you is then that each nk log nk has to equal, I've got just the log nk, that's right. So each log nk must equal lambda, because I can independently vary these nks. And that just tells you that the nks all equal one another. Because they sum to capital N, therefore they equal N over C, because the C of them. And look what we've got for the entropy now. S is equal to K times this thing. So it equals KN log N minus, and then this thing. But we know that the NK is N upon C. And these things are already cancelling. And now, the sum here is just going to give us the same term C times, so we'll be left with minus N log N upon C. And that's just get times K, of course. And that's just going to give me KN log N minus NK log N, but then I've got the further factor plus MK log C. Okay, and this is the problem. Because that quantity is not extensive. If I double the volume, I'm going to double the number of cells, and I'm going to double the number of particles. This thing does not double. Okay, so I went through this just to show how it really follows in a very elementary and fundamental way through this Boltzmann combinatorics expression. And the way to solve the problem, well, if I subtract off nk log n, then I'll divide this by n, and now this thing will stay unchanged when I double the volume. C doubles, and so does n, and then the factor here doubles. So then I get back the extensive entropy. So I have to subtract off an nk log n, which is to say, forget about constants, I need to divide by capital N factorial. So that's what all the fuss is about in terms of this n factorial. Classically, how do we divide through by this unwanted n factorial? And one point to make, of course, is that if you do that, it seems this is nonsense, or at least it makes nonsense of the original way we arrived at the expression, which after all was through a combinatorics calculation. How many ways of distributing particles divided through by capital N factorial, and you're left with something that's much less than one. So somehow the whole thing becomes nonsense. Well, okay, there's a simple solution to all of this, though.
Can I make you up a little bit?
Yes, of course.
There's a couple of interesting things about the Gibbs paradox when you take a limit from two gases to a single gas.
So yes.
I guess I never thought about this. So I would have thought that, well, okay, at some point, if you try a limit like this, then at some point the membranes are not going to be able to distinguish
the
two molecules, and then your process is no longer reversible. You have to change it to just removing the partition.
That's right. That's right.
In that limit.
That's right. And at that point, it's no longer an experimental question.
Right, but I can view this as being a discontinuous jump between this result and the zero result.
Yes.
And you said, let's put a daemon inside here, and I was wondering whether, so now it becomes a bit more intricate, and you have to worry about the memory.
Of course, we're into all that Landau stuff. Yes.
But it works out that way, that was my question.
So yes, I think so. Oh, yes, I think so. I think all of that goes to the right.
Okay.
I've set up a little puzzle here, but it's a very simple puzzle and it's easily solved. And the trick to it is to recognize that this quantity, and what we were defining the entropy as S of K log W, this really is the most probable distribution of the N particles over the C cells. But really what we ought to be looking at is the total phase space volume available to the N particles. And if you do that, then it's not this that you have, it's instead replaced it by, you put it somewhere different. What you want instead is, well, put a star on that, it's the usual notation to indicate that it's the most probable distribution. You just take the total phase-phase volume. Now that's going to be the sum over all of these nk's, these occupation numbers nk's, such that the sum of them is equal to n, of this quantity. And what is this equal? C to the n, of course. We've got C cells, phase-phase growing particles, just use the F, and it's obvious on physical grounds. See how obvious it is, basically. And then the trick to the N factorial business is really what C ought to have in it as a volume element. We should have a unit of volume. So really what we ought to be talking about is C tor, where tor is the volume of one of these cells. That to the nth power is the real volume, and now we should be looking at the quotient of phase space under permutation, which is just dividing by a capital N factorial. Okay. So there's a small shift in how one looks at this, and then it becomes perfectly clear how one can get the needed division by N factorial. It reflects the fact that permutations of particles in phase space, a point that's mapped into another point by a permutation, should be taken to represent the same physical configuration. Okay. Something we do all the time. So that ought to be the solution. There shouldn't be all of these talks about it being incomprehensible and a contradiction and so on and so forth. This seems to me entirely mistaken. Okay, but of course I've got to do quite a bit more work than that, haven't I?
Does this point being made in the literature on what you just said?
Not that I know of, no. Now, I've never been able to, I've had to puzzle all of this out myself. I've never read a thing on this that makes any sense to me. Yeah, I'm sure. But,
go on.
I'm sorry, but I want to say that there's more to this sort of concern, okay? And I haven't tackled it yet. So come back to Bach. And Bach is a very sophisticated man, no question about it. He's a brilliant mathematician. He's thought hard about this. He studied the history in great detail. He's written a really excellent paper on Boltzmann. Boltzmann was first introduced in distinguishable particles, by the way, back in 1877. But Bach, for all of his defense of classical indistinguishability, which is what he's doing in this book, this is his point. Indistinguishable classical particles have no trajectories. The unconventional role of indistinguishable classical particles is best expressed by the fact that in a deterministic setting, no indistinguishable particles exist, or equivalently, that indistinguishable classical particles have no trajectories. Before I give a formal proof, I argue as follows. Suppose they have trajectories, then the particles can be identified by them and are therefore not indistinguishable. Okay.
Very good. Question about this book. What is called indistinguishable classical particles?
Yeah.
So the whole argument of it is that they can't exist?
They have no trajectories.
Okay.
Okay. Now let's see. And here's what he goes on to do. Definition, what he does is formal proof. Then definition, if we define indistinguishability equals identity of the particles plus symmetry of the state, then all contradictions mentioned above vanish or become meaningless. Okay, and now the point is, and we need to go back really to his previous quotation. This point, prior to the description of the state by means of probability notions. See, what he's saying is, as long as you've got a degenerate description, probability notions, then it's one can impose the requirement of permutability, and then we have indistinguishability, and that's what indistinguishability means. Now, how is that different in quantum mechanics? There too, of course, we have probability mechanics, but we have the pure state. Okay, so Bach isn't quarreling with quantum indistinguishability. The quantum pure state can be permutable, anti-symmetrized or symmetrized. Now, what is the analog of the quantum pure state? Of course, the classical pure state. So the claim is, and this is Bach's point, you can't have classical pure states and have them be permutable, because then you couldn't have trajectories. I said that right. You can't have classical pure states and then be permutable. Yeah, because then you don't have trajectories. And I have to go through his formal proof really to show you quite what he means about that.
What do you mean by can't be permutable? You mean the state is divided, is modded out by the permutations.
To be permutable is to be, yes. It's invariant under the permutations.
You don't mean to be permutable, you mean to be commutative, or modded out by permutations.
What we're talking about, when I say
it's invariant.
A permutable description, I mean one that is invariant under the permutations.
Okay, so, but isn't a return, I mean, is the issue the following? I mean, if I believe in classical mechanics ontologically, then I simply do believe that there are trajectories because that's part of the belief system that goes along with classical mechanics. And then I do not believe in classical indistinguishability, is that right?
Then classical indistinguishability makes no sense at the level of pure state description, because a pure state description will assign trajectories to the particles. But if I refrain from a pure state description, if I've got something much more degenerate, which does not allow me to determine the trajectory of each particle, then maybe permutability is, then one has permutability, or may have permutability. You can have probability, maybe.
But
which are permutable symmetric.
Sure. Okay. But is there a physical consequence of whether or not I mean, in quantum mechanics, we simply don't believe in trajectories and we accept all the consequences. But in classical mechanics, I can take a point of view in which I believe that there are trajectories, but I'm not interested in a description that includes them. But there can't be physical consequences of forgetting my belief in the trajectories. Or are you claiming there are?
Well, Bach's claim, and what this whole book is about, is if we do look at degenerate descriptions of classical particles which do not allow us to infer their trajectories, those descriptions may be invariant under permutations. And then one has interesting statistical results that apply only to such measures that are permutable in that way. So I think all of those results, of course, leave them tacked to your belief that the classical. But look, can I go on? Because it'll become clearer as to what's, in a sense, going on about all of this. Now, Bach's proof, his formal proof, is to say he defines two sets. So call one set V, one set W. V is the set of coordinates. He defines coordinates as extremals of the measures over just take two particles in one dimension. So extremals of the measures over R2 and delete the points along the diagonal B where x equals y. So V is going to be the set of all of these. So extremals of measures mu on R2, take out V. Okay. W is going to be the probability measures, likewise on RT, take out the diagonals, but now required to be symmetric. Okay, now look at this is a simplex, look at the extremals. And they're of the form so delta function which maps points on R2 to 0 if that point on R2 is not the point xy and infinite otherwise, usual thing. And then the observation is that these two sets have zero intersection. Okay. Now there's a very straightforward response to this. Namely, why think that the coordinates for classical particles, why think they're of this form rather than of the form R2 quotient out the permutations? Why not take the set of points related to one another by permutations, just a classical configuration space, why not take that set of points as representing a single point? Why not take a set of points in the phase space as representing a physical system? And then, of course, this argument collapses. So this is something about no less much as considered. Okay. So what's going wrong there? I don't understand this. I mean, why is it with that conception that here one has a representation? Don't confuse mathematics with reality. Because reality is mathematics. Mathematical representation is a set of points in phase space, mapped into one another by permutation. That set represents the physical system. What's wrong with that? Well, let me go further along that line of thought. Now, let's go back. Yes, of course.
This representation you're talking about is an everyday thing. It's commonly used in the quantum context. So it's very peculiar.
Absolutely.
That people classically would absolutely doing
it. Absolutely. I mean, I can only think that these are disjoint communities that somehow work on these things. Anybody with a broader experience in physics would be very familiar with the idea that one passes to equations under symmetries of closed systems, and why not do that? It's a natural thing.
There's really freedom of choice here. I can choose to take your definition and work from it, and it would reproduce the correct statistics, or I could make another choice and say that my state is really not to be, not to be modified by the permutations. I don't see that as being necessarily a wrong choice. It's just that it doesn't.
Sure. No, no, absolutely. I think we're yet in the realm of, you know, what is physically correct, because the extensibility of the entropy business, we already agreed that, you know, is not an empirical question when the particles are sufficiently the same, they're failing maximum Riemann. But I think that, I mean, nevertheless, I do favor using the reduced phase space. I mean, extensibility is a natural problem. But more than that, watch what happens. Now, I think part of the intuition is that most people are thinking that, well, what do I mean by a permuted state of affairs? And they're thinking, among other things, well, just because it looks different. And they're somehow thinking of permuting particles which have different trajectories, and you stick the trajectories in different places, like this. But this is clearly nonsense. When one talks about permuting points of phase space, it's not that somehow one interchanges the falling teapot, you know, with the glass that sits on the table. It's nonsense. What one's doing is saying something much more subtle than that. And I think the best way I can convey this is, I think, let me go through a linguistic example, sort of thing philosophers do. First of all, I'm presenting you with a theorem, which is something I just proved, but I'm pretty sure it's right. So let L be a first order language without any proper names. Okay, so no names. Let T be any L sentence satisfiable only in models of cardinality N. Then there is a totally symmetric predicate G, such that in the sentence there exists x1 through to xn, that G is logically equivalent to T. So true in all and only the same models that T is true in. And let me just give a simple illustration of the theorem. If I consider that T is my original sentence, it fits in this form. Where F is not a symmetric predicate, then it's logically equivalent to, well, x1, xn, or F, x2, x1, xn, or, and keep going. It's a very elementary logic to see that that must be right. And let me illustrate it. Bob is listening to the talk, not Alice. Now, if I symmetrize that and say Bob is listening to the talk, not Alice, or Alice is listening to the talk, not Bob, so there I've got FBA or FAB. It seems I'm giving you no information. But suppose you've got a language which is rich enough to get rid of proper names. X is B-shaped. X is B-shaped because this is the talk, not Y, and it's A-shaped. It's F prime. The new factor is F prime. Now what happens if I symmetrize? X is B-shaped as listening to the talk, not Y, who is A-shaped, or Y is B-shaped and is listening to the talk, not X, who is A-shaped. Okay. Are you starting to see the point? The point about permutability is, as long as you can permute the bearers of properties, then it will make no difference. Okay, as long as you include all of the relevant properties. Of course, if some properties are not included and are germane to the physics, then you better not have to use those. But if you've got all of the properties that are relevant to the physics, then permutation of what is left will make no difference. And then you can identify them. And the point about the theorem as opposed to this illustration, I mean, this is a very special case. The theorem is a harder thing to prove, and it's really saying that in full generality, anything that you can say that is true of only an object can be said in such a way as to be permutable. Okay. Now, that makes it all seem completely metaphysical. I mean, then the whole thing has become metaphysics, and that's the view of some philosophers of physics. This is David Arbut. He's using a fancy word, exaeticism, for ordinary phase space, that's hexaistic phase space. And then if you identify points related by permutations, that's anti-hexaistic. Okay, and this feeds into a lot of the debates about philosophy of space and time and so forth. And so he's saying here, he's particularly looking at the second law. There's a certain fairly trivial sense in which it ought to have been obvious from the outset. The facts of thermodynamics cannot possibly shed any light on the truth or falsehood of the doctrine of hexaism. The question of the truth or falsity of the second law of thermodynamics is, after all, a straightforwardly empirical one, and the question of hexaism, the question that is of whether or not certain observationally identical situations are identical simpliciter, manifestly is not. And then he goes on to qualify, well, maybe we make a difference of simplicity or elegance or something like that. And he's saying that you might have thought the hexaistic language would be simpler or something. And he concludes that is not the case, and it needed work to get to this. But actually, I think he's completely mistaken about both cases. And you can see that he's mistaken about the first case. Because, heavens, if imposing indistinguishability, so taking a description which is invariant under permutations, going to reduce classical phase space, if that's just a philosophical trick, a philosophical step with no physical significance, then maybe it's backed up by the observation that entropy of mixing for indistinguishable particles is not empirically observable. But what about quantum mechanics? I mean, that exactly the same issue arises. You identify the points in the state space of quantum mechanics, which are related by permutations. In other words, you look in the symmetrized and anti-symmetrized states. You look to that subspace of the Hilbert space. There's a difference in statistics. If this was right, then that should be something that's not empirical. I mean, it clearly isn't. So, this business of permutability and so forth, it's somewhat philosophical and yet not completely without physical importance. And only now, I think, do we really get to the riddle, which is the one that I'll solve. But it's not a hard riddle. I mean, the difficult thing is to pose the question properly. To be explained, distinguishable classical particles obey Maxwell-Boltzmann statistics. Indistinguishable classical particles obey Maxwell-Boltzmann statistics. It makes no difference to the statistics. I mean, what I've shown you so far is only that, let's see, one goes to this, the quotient phase space, and works within that, and you get out an extensive entropy and so forth. I haven't shown that it gives you the same entropy function otherwise, but it does. But now in the quantum case, distinguishable quantum particles obey Maxwell-Boltzmann statistics, indistinguishable quantum particles obey one of the quantum statistics. So what's going on? There is some important difference between classical phase space, quantum, state space, whatever, which leads to this decision. Okay, so that's what I'll now, let's solve this, and it's not terribly hard. I need to put up some more equations. All right, so the first point is perhaps I should have just elaborated on this just a little bit. A point that Raphael helped me on with, actually. If this is right, and this is the phase space volume, so the logarithm of that ought to be the entropy. For the extensive entropy, if you think about it, divide the system into two. So entropy, total entropy is the sum of the two. Entropy is the logarithm of the volume. So the total volume should be the product of the volume. Is this volume, is the total volume the product of the two volumes? Well, so we're looking at 2C, C the number of cells, double the volume, double that number. Forget about the tor. 2N factorial. That's what one would write down as the phase space volume for the total system. What would the phase space volume for each of them be? It would be c to the n over n factorial. So these are all reduced phase space volumes. So this thing's squared. Are these things equal? No. But the logarithms are. OK. Okay. The logarithm of this thing equals the logarithm of this thing in the standard approximation. And the point that Raphael helped me out with, well, what does it mean? The non-exact, you know, the fact that there's only an approximation of it, what does that really mean? Because it's good physics in it. Because a situation where you've got exactly n particles here and exactly n particles here is not going to be, you remove the partition and out of the mix, then you'll have some fluctuations, you'll have a little bit more on one side, a little bit more on the other. You know, the phase space description should be good. So I think that's responsible for how come we don't have exact equality. But in the logarithm of the standard approximation. And that's not true, of course, for the Boltzmann expression. All right, but now let me continue now with the issue of classical versus quantum statistics. Now, what I've been looking at is really just a...
Yeah, I guess you could test this idea, because if you were to express the right-hand side as a product of, n1, n2, and then require that n1 plus n2 be n, if they are to be equal to high order in the large approximation, that would give you a bound on the size of the fluctuations.
Yes, absolutely. But let's recognize now that really what we're interested in is regions of phase space with different energies, so say from 1 to j. We now want to have C for the kth such region, nk particles in the ck number of cells for the kth region. We're looking at total phase space volumes. Now, if it was Maxwell-Boltzmann, we have this factor, and then we have at times. I'll put a double line then here to distinguish it from what I have here. These expressions, I'm sorry, so I'm taking the product of these quantities. Now, this combinatorics factor, you see here I've got the phase space volume for nk particles distributed over ck cells. This combinatorics factor is, well, which of the k particles that I choose, which nk particles do I choose to distribute over these ck cells for the k region phase space? And I can make many choices out of the total. So I have to further multiply by this combinatorics expression, and then I'm summing over all choices of these numbers such that 1 to j is equal to the total number, and also such that the energy k, nk, is equal to the total energy. Okay, so that's the full... the full factor for the phase space volume. Okay. Now, the quantum mechanical expression in parallel to this is, rather than this factor, the expression ck plus nk minus 1 factorial over nk factorial ck minus 1 factorial. Okay. And again, the sum over exactly the same conditions, and this factor is missing entirely because it is the initial product. The new thing makes a difference. What's the difference? It's solely between this quantity and this one. Okay?
This is just both of
them. Yeah, here I'm going. Sorry. Here I'm going. Now, should I just go through how to get this factor just quickly? It's very simple. This is due to Ehrenfest. The point here is that one's got nk particles distributed over ck cells, but you don't care about permutations among themselves. So you can represent the situation just by giving the number in one cell then the number in the second cell, number in the third cell, and so forth, up until, and I'll have some number NC. You've got CK cells. So this would be one possible distribution, which will be an assignment where all of these n's add up to capital NK. But now I'm going to count them the same if I commute them. So how many possible sequences of symbols can I produce in this way? Let me do these dots. Maybe it would be better if I did it with p's. Okay, so this is a symbol of p's, strings of p's, a dash, strings of p's, a dash, strings of p's, a dash, and so on. How many possible such strings of symbols like this are there? Well, there's ck plus nk minus one of them. The number of cells is ck, but the number of dashes is ck minus one. Right? Is that good? So if I, the total number of permutations of these is just this quantity, but now I could divide through by just commuting the p's among the cells. That's the nk factorial. And just commuting the ck vertical bars here among the cells, that's the ck minus 1 factor. So that's the expression that replaces this, which is the number of ways of distributing the nk particles over the ck cells. Okay, everything else is exactly the same. So the subtle difference between classical statistics and quantum statistics, I'm looking here at those Einstein, lies in the relationship of this expression to this expression. Now, let me. So far, I've given you the usual standard Boltzmann distinguishable particles. Let me now go to the classical indistinguishable particles. Well, then, rather than this, one divides through by the nk factorials, and one doesn't have this at all. Okay. So, classical indistinguishable particles differ from quantum distinguishable particles. Only, and now you see this summation has exactly the same conditions. I'm sorry, I misspoke earlier. So the classical indistinguishable particle statistics differ from quantum statistics only by this factor in comparison to this factor.
Sorry, can you go through the quantum argument again?
The quantum argument to get this factor?
Yeah.
One's distributing nk particles over ck cells. I'm representing the CK cells first, second, third, and then and correspondingly first, second, third dash up to CK minus one dash. The last one doesn't need a dash to close it off. So the number of particles, I've just got a certain number here, n1, little n2, little n3, whatever. I'm representing them by strings of p's. So the total number of symbols in the sequence is CK plus NK minus one. The total number of distinct sequences, just how many different such sequences are there? Well, factorial, but divide through when I just commute the p's among themselves, or I just commute the vertical dashes among themselves. So divide through by these two.
I guess what I don't understand is why you can't use the same argument for classical indistinguishable.
Well, you'll see in a moment why this matters. You'll see in a moment how this matters. Let's just look at this quantity and this quantity. How are they related? Answer, so long as CK is large in comparison to NK, they're approximately the same. Is that obvious? So if CK is larger than NK, what have we got? We have. The ck minus 1 factorial will cancel out from this. And what we've got here is ck plus nk minus 1, and then. And so forth. When we get down to the ck minus 1, and then looking at the rest of the factorial expressions, this will cancel it. So we can draw a line at this point, forget about what's to the right, and we've just got this thing divided by nk factorial. But this thing because CK is much larger than NK, is effectively CK product with itself NK times. So it's just CK to the NK power. It's CK to the NK power divided by the NK factorial. So this quantity just does equal this quantity in this machine, which is the high temperature region. Or if you've got a very diluted low temperature system. So the sole difference between quantum and classical statistics lies in the discrepancy between these two when we're not in this regime. Okay, that's it. That's the end of the story. So now what happens when we're not in that regime? Do it for n equals 2 particles, 3 cells in phase space. And we don't have to worry about different values of decay, because all of the rest is the same anyway. So just restrict oneself to a single region of phase space, keep CK small, make it 3 cells, 2 particles, and it becomes visually immediate. What's happening classically, when I look to the reduced phase space, I'm representing the physical system, the 2 particle pair in this way. Look at the measure in particular for 2 particles both in region in the cell 3, it's half the measure. Say one particle in cell 2 and one particle in cell 3, not saying which one, of course. Okay, likewise for this, with the 2 particles in the region, it's half the measure of when one particle is in 2 and one particle is in 1. That's just Boltzmann statistics. Okay? Two heads, a head and a tail is twice as probable as two heads. That's just Boltzmann statistics. We're not changing statistics by going to the classical question space. But look what happens in the quantum mechanical case. Well, let's just point out that this is about heads and tails. But go to quantum mechanics. You've just got the points. You don't have any other volume measure. You've just got the points. And they're all equally probable. It is no longer the case that the 2 particles in region 3 has half the measure of a particle in region 3 and a particle in region 2. Therein lies the entire difference between quantum and classical statistics. Okay, so there's more to say here, but I'm running a bit short of time, and we can analyze it in more detail perhaps for the coin tossing business, if you like. But the crucial issue is this. Quantum statistics arise, of course, in order to have this, just the points rather than these areas or volumes in phase space, we're going to Hilbert space, of course, with a different structure of state space entirely. To put it in phase space terms, it's because there's elementary volumes of phase space, which of course is to do with the existence of Planck's constant. So all of this, in a way, becomes now tremendously familiar, because this is how people at Planck were thinking of it back in 1911, in particular, the first Solvay conference, when Planck presented his, one of many of his derivations of the Planck distribution. It was based on the idea that rather than integrate over phase space, you replace the integral by a discrete sum over ellipses in phase space. And indeed, it made all the difference between obtaining the Wien law rather than the Planck distribution. But in that same year, 1911, Ehrenfest and independently Natanson came up with the indistinguishability business. And from that point on, everyone, Planck included, thought, indistinguishability is responsible for quantum statistics. And we lost sight of this original insight. But the original insight was the correct one. Indistinguishability has got something to do with it. Look, let's go again, let's see. If we're looking at these points, this counting these points is not a good estimate of the volume of the square. So what if I've got distinguishability, and I don't commute out the I don't quotient out the permutations, then I'm in this. Counting the points now is proportional to the phase space volume. It's exactly proportional to the
phase space volume.
Sorry?
Let's regularize all the systems, including the box. And then all this volume, I forgot about all this volume, this is a historical artifact. You should measure, and you should count the number of states. And then there's only quantum statistics and not the physical statistics. And then what we want to see, that Sakurai control the formula is the same for water and for chemistry in classical readings. And that's it.
Yes, of course you can do that, but I'm also saying you can do this other thing, which is classical indistinguishable.
But it's all about quantum mechanics. Classical mechanics is just something.
I think misunderstood what I just said. What I said is if you take quantum distinguishable particles and you do quantum statistics for distinguishable particles, you're still counting states, you're still counting these points, you're still in Hilbert space. But now the count of the points is proportional to the classical phase space problem. And therefore, quantum statistics for distinguishable particles is Maxwell-Boltzmann just as classical statistics. You deny that?
I know the number of states. Now the number is just this discrete number of states. And some approximations are proportional to volume. This is a wild formula.
Can I just make that completely clear? You're absolutely right.
No, First of all,
I just want to make the point that the count of the states here is exactly proportional to the volume if you have distinguishable quantum particles.
No. It depends, for example, for small volume, it depends on the shape of the volume.
Ah, very sure. Oh, yes, no, I know. There are boundary effects and stuff. No point.
And I don't forget about it, just and you can.
No, that's
this line of reasoning from the beginning to the end, you can forget about the point of space. You should count the number by thinking.
Sure. Thinking that the system is really a quantum system all along, then of course, that's what you'll do. Of course. Yeah. But I'm interested in the self-consistency of classical system mechanics. I'm interested in the conceptual question of whether the thing that's
similar is like great westfield I tell you what,
would you like to, should we add this fight afterwards? Because I would like to finish this talk, okay? So in the distinguishable case, you've got exact proportionality, modulus, surface effects, and boundary effects, and so forth. In the, you go to the reduced phase space, the count of these points is no longer a good estimate. Now, of course, what if the elementary volume is reduced? So now I've got thousands of these things, and I count the states now. Well, now, of course, it becomes again a good estimate, which is, of course, just the limit in which quantum statistics gives you back classical statistics. Okay, the highest energy limit. Now, I've got something more to say about, well, where does distinguishability really come from? And I guess I just want to make, just let me make a point here. The point about distinguishability, look again at the classical case, and just now we'll do this for coins. We have two coins, heads and tails and so forth. Now, introduce some property of the coins, red, green, color, okay? So further subdivide the face. But now require that these properties be robust under the process of throwing the coins, whatever. Well, that introduces certain exclusions. One coin is red, one coin is blue, and they remain so. You can't have that you toss the coins and suddenly you find you've got two red coins, two green coins. So these, the blackened out regions, are not accessible. Now look at what you've got that's left that is accessible. Four equal volumes. And now we can just rearrange these. We call one of the coins the red coin, call the other the green coin, and have distinguishable particles. And here's a phase-based description in terms of distinguishable particles. And essentially, that is the further thing, is where the whole notion of distinguishable particles arises, through having these robust properties that we can use as names. And then, of course, there's nothing wrong with working using the unreduced phase space, but you don't question that computation. Nothing wrong with it, but nothing particularly right with it either. You might think there's something mystical about names. You could have stayed with the reduced phase space and just worked with this. And that would have done exactly the same job. Slightly better because it still gives you the extensive entropy. Okay, so my conclusions. Indistinguishability, permittivity is classically innocuous, makes perfect sense classically. It's desirable given extensive entropy. Quantum statistics arises as distinct from classical because one, both indistinguishability and because you're replacing a continuous state space by one which, where the measure is concentrated on points, namely Hilbert space. Or that's the finished jigsaw. Okay. So thank you all.
I think you made an interesting point just before that, you know, classical mechanics was standing really well on its own before quantum mechanics ever appeared, and you certainly have the right to ask for a purely consistent theory of statistical classical mechanics, and it always seems to be a little bit of a problem that this n factorial seemed to spoil the self-consistency of the
yes.
But I think they have a very, very nice resolution of this by just a redefinition of what the microstate is supposed to be.
Well, I may have to point out a further development here. What it would mean in quantum mechanics is you could take collections of particles that are different. If you were to include in the state description their mass, charges, then the particle is indistinguishable, and you would have a permutation symmetry running in such an indistinguishable description.